Okay. Welcome, everybody. It's a pleasure. Welcome back, Rabbi Daniel Friedman from the Teaneck Jewish Center, who last spoke on Parshat Yitro. I was looking it up. And really, I first of all, I want to thank him. I guess really, he's him and his wife, Dr. Chaya, are sponsoring tonight's year. They want to dedicate tonight's year in memory of Sarah Rudolph Olshin, a beloved wife, daughter, sister, and aunt. I understand passed away a young woman, and we should hear good news and smachot. So thank you for that, and all of us should have good occasions. And like we like to say here, wish people a long life. Rabbi Friedman, as I mentioned, is the rabbi of the Teaneck Jewish Center. He's also a rebbe at TABC. That's Torah Academy of Bergen County, correct? And he teaches the Beit Medrash of Teaneck, and I'm sure many of you have heard of him before, and it's a pleasure to welcome back for as we make Chazak Chazak on Sefer Bamidbar. And Mata Masa, I know it's extremely rare that these parshiot are split up. It's almost always we have 253 psukim we have to listen through on Shabbat. So Vakasha, Rabbi, let's go.
Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman. Appreciate it. And it's a big chus for me to be here. Just a very brief word about the sponsorship. One of the things that I'm very grateful for this the forum for Habatzas HaTorah, which is a wonderful thing in general, but the first time that I joined Torah in Motion, so it was a great delight and the most pleasant surprise that somebody that I'd spent a lot of time with in my days on the West Side of Manhattan, Hedda Rudolph, was on the shiur and participating as she always did. And so that's why I thought that it would be appropriate. This sponsorship is for Hedda's daughter, and Hedda and Shelley, Zichrona Levracha, were very, 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 very special and dear on the West Side. And their loss is felt very acutely. And Sarah's neshama should have an aliyah, and her husband Ira and the children should always have wonderful memories of the many family members who unfortunately are no longer with us. And so that's what I wanted to do and what we wanted to do in terms of the sponsorship. As Rabbi Kelman mentioned, we have a double parsha. Double parshios in general, I'm not complaining here about Chazal and the way they organize things, but are very challenging because it can sometimes leave us in a position of feeling like we're doing a little bit more triage than, going in depth, but we'll do our best. And that's uniquely true of Matos Maaseh. But I actually think that person thinks deeply about not just the Sedra, but in this case, the Sedros that we have. There's really a through line, and it touches on something else that Rabbi Kelman mentioned, which is that this is the end of Sefer Bamidbar. And I think, as I titled this year, Out of the Wilderness, if you want to understand how to get out of the Midbar, so to speak, I think there is a message in Matos Maaseh, but one that we have to, work to understand. So let's begin, and we're not going to go chronologically for now. I'm going to begin at the beginning of Maaseh, and then we'll circle back to Matos. And there are four basic parts of the narrative that I want to discuss, which will be the war against Midian, which is very important, and a kind of a coda to the entire incident of Baal Peor. And that will be the first thing that we'll discuss. The second is the very fascinating exchange between Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven and Moshe Rabbeinu in terms of the Eiver HaYarden, the Transjordan, and what that is all about. I think that's a critical section. The third comes up in Parshas Maaseh, which is the story of the Rotzeach B'Shkaga and the Ir Miklat, and what that's about. And then the fourth and final story is actually the last element in Sefer Bamidbar, which is a coda to something that came up much earlier in terms of the Benos Tzlavchad, Parshas Pinchas. This is the second half of that story. And that it is the end of Sefer Bamidbar. And we'll try to explain and understand what these narratives have to do with each other. But let's begin by making an observation. So we know that the Masaos of Bnei Yisrael are recorded, hence Parshas Maaseh, the Maaseh Bnei Yisrael. It's rather striking that there's no discussion in any depth of Matan Torah. If you were going to review something, you would think, you know, Maimed Har Sinai would make the cut. Maybe Kriyas Yamsuf would be discussed. There's nothing more than an allusion to the Chet HaMeraglim. The Chet HaEgel is skipped over. And all of the Masos of Bnei Yisrael, it's a remarkable thing. The only incident of 40 years in the desert which gets any attention in this summation, Eila Masa Bnei Yisrael, Asher Yatsu Me'eretz Mitzrayim L'Tzivosam B'Yad Moshe V'Aaron. Does anybody know what the only incident which is discussed in any detail? And it's shocking relative to the omissions that we just enumerated. So what's the only event which is recounted? Again, not Matan Torah, not Kriyas Yamsuf.
Death of Aaron?
Yes. Who said that? Noreen, am I saying that right? Noreen? Okay. It's outstanding. Yeah. The death of Aaron HaKohen. It's also the only Yahrzeit recorded in the Torah, which is coming up this week, which is Rosh Chodesh Av, which itself is a very striking point. Okay, so the Torah is drawing our attention to the persona of Aaron HaKohen, and maybe that's even the linchpin, as we'll see. It's not that the death of Aaron HaKohen is objectively more important than Matan Torah. As important as Aaron HaKohen is, that nothing could be more important than that, or Yetzias Mitzrayim. So we have to try to understand what that's about. What is the Torah drawing our attention to? And by the way, it's not only the death of Aaron, but right, it's the immediate aftermath. It's Vayishma Kananim Melech Arad Yoshia Ben Egev. We have a little bit of review of that story, of the impact of the death of Aaron on Klal Yisrael. Like I say, the only Yortzeit which is recorded in the Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu's Yortzeit is derived by the Gemara, Masechta Megillah, that it's Zayin Adar. There's a lot of computation and mathematics involved in that. We don't know when Avram Avinu passed away. You know, we don't have any biblical recording of the Yortzeit of Sarah Imenu, despite the fact that the Torah, you know, pays a great deal of attention to, you know, her death, and that's the source of Hesped and Bechia and Kavura. But the death of Aaron is, you know, marked with the Yortzeit. You could probably figure out when Miriam died. It sounds like she died in Rosh Chodesh Nisan, but that's not as explicit. Here, you know, the Torah is absolutely explicit. And, you know, again, not just in Parshas Chukas when Aaron HaKohen passes away, but here the Torah says so explicitly. So that certainly is, as we like to say in the language of Chazal, that is Omer Darsheni. That requires explication and analysis. And so we'll hold that, not too far in the rearview mirror, but let's put that to the side and let's now go through the four narratives that I, you know, discussed. Okay, so we'll talk about the war against Midian. As we know, this is a follow-up to the Avon of Baal Peor. It's interesting that Midian is singled out, and it's not Moab, and there's an entire discussion of why Midian and not Moab, which I won't get into now, and I won't even get into the battle itself, which is important enough. The way that the battle was waged was very noteworthy. It wasn't all of Klal Yisrael. It was a relatively small group, Elef Lamata, only 1,000, you know, soldiers from each tribe, 12,000 soldiers total. And there were Sarei Alefim, Visarei Meos, so there were 12, like, generals, if you want to call them. And then, you know, there were, colonels under them, I suppose. So there was a group of 132 officers. But, a very small group, and they, devastate Midian. And then the aftermath is a very fascinating section of the Torah. And the Torah actually goes into great detail explaining the aftermath. And there's a lot of halachos which are derived, what we call Giule Midian. Those who have studied for Smicha know we spend a lot of time with Giule Midian. It's one of the sources, the main sources of Yerodea and Huchos Kashras, how we Kashra Kalim, Kibolo Kachpoto. There's a lot of halachic and normative material here. But the point that I wanted to focus on is really in the narrative itself, is the way that the Shlal, the way that the spoils of war are dealt with. So anybody happen to remember there's an interesting feature here. You have 12,000 soldiers, and like I say, just, you know, over 100 in the officer corps, but let's just call it 12,000 plus. And then you have the rest of Klal Yisrael, so you have millions of people. And so what happens in terms of the Shlal? How is that dealt with, the spoils of war? I think Erica was saying something before, but then I lost her. Anybody?
Well, some of the spoils go to the Leviim.
Okay.
Some go to the soldiers themselves. and some go to the population, I think. It's
very good. Okay, good. So let's
fair, like a fair division.
Right, exactly right. So the Torah says, V'chatzisa samalkalach, bein tovsei ha-melchama v'in anshei ha-tzava. So the Torah lays out a fascinating principle that you would think, you know, to the victor go the spoils. So maybe that would be only the soldiers, but that's not the case. Right? And it's actually very, very fascinating because each group, the soldiers on the one hand and the rest of Klal Yisrael on the other, so they have to give a certain percentage of the spoils. And this is, I think, what Annie was referring to just a moment ago. As a gift to Hashem. There's a discussion in the Ramban. Was it a, you know, for Bedek Abayis? Was it actually like, you know, what we call, you know, Hekdesh Mizbeach? That's not entirely clear from the Pesukim, but it was, you know, considered to be a Mechas La Hashem, Harei Mosa Mechas La Hashem, and may have depended on what, you know, particular Chatzah, what particular substance we're talking about. But here, there was an adjustment, right? So those who went out to battle, who already, you know, had sacrificed a great deal in terms of putting their lives on the line, their rate of contribution was 1 out of 500 or 0.2%. Okay. The rest of the nation who got the other half of the spoils, they had to give echad min ha-chamishim or 2%. So they had to give at a rate 10 times the level of those who went out to war. So you have a very sophisticated division. On the one hand, in terms of raw materials, v'chatzisa es ha-malkalach, but in terms of, you know, how much each one got, so each soldier got much more than each average, you know, civilian, in the sense that, number one, there were only 12,000 of them. So if you're splitting, you know, the malkalach, if there, you know, are 16,000 people to divide between two groups, so you have millions of people that are going to take 8,000, and you have 12,000 are going to take 8,000, so that obviously already favors the soldiers. And then, again, the rate of meches la'ashem is 0.2% as opposed to 2%. And so what you have there is, you know, some kind of a reasonable distribution. I think that's what Annie was saying. Annie's formulation was right along those lines, right? A fair distribution. And I think that's exactly right. Okay, so that's the first incident I want to recount, and we're going to move through these, and then hopefully we'll make sense of them, and then we'll come back to Aaron Cohen, and hopefully we'll be able to, you know, make sense of it all. So the next story is actually one of the most difficult stories in the entire Torah. They put out, you know, years ago a Sefer HaYovel Yeshivat Har Etzion, a big zchus of learning in Yeshivat Har Etzion with Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal and Rav Amital Zatzal, whose Yahrzeit is just coming up. So in any event, I wrote about it in that book. It's a very difficult passage to understand because, you know, B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven seemingly do something that Moshe Rabbeinu is extremely concerned about. Moshe actually compares these two tribes to the Meraglim, which is not a compliment. Then somehow Moshe Rabbeinu is placated, or at least tolerates, something which is suggested by B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven in terms of how they're going to make this all work. So does anybody remember how the situation gets resolved, right? Moshe, at first, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say it's the most apoplectic. We see Moshe, you know, in the Torah, I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu lets them have it. And then somehow there's a modus vivendi. So what is that modus vivendi? How has that worked out?
It's resolved by letting God, the tribes of Gad and Reuben house their children, their wives, and their animals first, and then they'll go to war with the rest of the tribes.
Excellent. And is it...
Moshe is doing more than that, because the beginning, the Shevet Reuven and Gad mentioning they will make Sukkot to the Tzon, and later on they'll make for the family shelter. So number one, he's switching that. And the second, it's what the person ahead of me said, that if Yalu Chalutzim, if they will go ahead until the Nachala will be done, then he will agree. But in the end, he is switching another one and he's adding half of Chatzim Menashe.
Okay, good. There's a lot there, Chaim. Okay, very well done. And Rashi certainly makes some of those notes. But let's just, you know, focus on that one point. So it's not just that they have to go to war, but they go right in front of the rest of the people, right? Anachnu Navor Chalutzim, right? Navor Chushim Lifnei Am in Sefer Yoshua and Perek Aleph. That commitment is revisited. But it's not only that. How long were they there? There's actually a really interesting discussion. How
50
long?
50 years.
How long?
14 years.
14 years, right. So initially,
15 years. Yeah.
When it was proposed, so it was for the years of Kibush, the Kibush Rabim, 7 years of conquest. Then B'nai Gad and B'nai Ruvain throw in another 7 years, the 7 years of Chiluk as well, which is like, you know, not a trivial point in the negotiation. They throw that in and they say, you know, Ad Hisnachel B'nai Yisrael, Yishnachel Aso, that took another 7 years. That's a remarkable sacrifice. They're away from their family for 14 years. You know, Rabbi Akiva gets a lot of credit for 12, and then, okay, then he signed up for another 12. But that's a very significant, concession. So they're away from their families for 14 years, and Moshe Rabbeinu says, Im Tasunas Adavarzan. Interestingly, Al Pi Halacha, especially the Shitas Reb Meir, this becomes sort of the paradigm of all stipulations in Halacha. We call it Tanai Kafel, Tanai B'nai Gad, B'nai Ruvain, Tanai Kodim Lamaisa. There's a lot of, you know, Hein Kodim Lav. We look at this as sort of like an archetype of how deals can be struck, which is also, I think, really, really fascinating. So a second incident. Let's move just to the third incident, which is a third piece of the narrative that I'm interested in focusing on, which is the story of the Rotzeach Bishgaga. Okay, so how does the Torah, generally speaking, deal with sometimes called the negligent murder or the accidental murder? We don't have a great translation for that, but Rotzeach Bishgaga, how does the Torah negotiate that? On the one hand, he didn't kill B'mezid, he didn't kill on purpose, so he can't be, you know, sentenced for capital murder, you know, by the Beis Din, which would be Misas Hereg. On the other hand, you know, he's not innocent. So what's the, you know, what is the way that the Torah manages this situation?
Ir Miklat.
Right. Okay, so how long does he have to go to the Ir Miklat?
Until the Kohen, as long as the Kohen is alive, he stays there.
Yeah, which Kohen?
The Kohen Gadol.
Yeah, interesting. Another appearance of the Kohen Gadol. Why the Kohen Gadol?
Aaron died. Maybe that's the reason why the Torah tells us about the death of Aaron.
Okay, you want to elaborate on that?
Well, they're leaving the Midbar here. They're getting ready to. They think they're ready to leave the Midbar. They're getting their freedom just as the Rotzeach gets his freedom with the death of the Kohen Gadol leaving the Ir Miklat.
So very fascinating. So you're saying that what's really going on here is that they're like a Rotzeach Bishgaga, this generation? They're like, that's right. Your comparison.
That was a Chiddush that I wrote up something like 40 years ago.
So I'm just fascinated by the theory. What's the basis for comparing them to Rotzeach Bishgaga? Where do we see that?
Well, Moshe himself was a Rotzeach, wasn't he, in Mitzrayim? So his hands are not completely clean.
Right, but he's not leaving the Midbar, and he was a Rotzeach B'mezid, not a Rotzeach Bishgaga.
No, but Aaron is the good brother of a.
I'm just fascinated. Your premise here is fascinating. You're saying that really the entire, you know, generation is like, you know, Begeder, Bechinas, Rotzeach, Bishgaga. Who did they kill?
They killed the Mitzrim in Kriyat Yamsuf. I mean, they're not completely innocent. The angels wanted to sing Hallel, and Hashem said, "What Masa Yadai Tobin Bayam." So there is a relationship between Kriyat Yam Suf and the fact that the Bnei Israel were leaving the
Why Israel. Would that? Why wouldn't that be the previous generation? What does that have to do with this generation?
He also didn't kill them. The Yam Suf, Hashem killed the Egyptians, not the Jews. They didn't fight the
But he wouldn't have killed the Egyptians if the Bnei Israel hadn't been leaving the Mitzrayim.
I only...
It's a very, it's a creative theory. I'm not sure. I don't see how. Yeah, but I blame
the Jews for the Egyptians drowning in the sea. They did not cause them to drown.
It's a very fascinating theory. I just was interested in pulling on that thread a little bit because I think it's an interesting point. I don't agree, but I think that's really.
It doesn't make sense.
How do you explain that? Yeah, I agree with you. I was challenging it myself, but I, we're all amongst friends. I appreciate Gershon's creativity. So the point is, that Gershon is right, that it does draw attention to the death of Aaron. There's a death of a Kohen Gadol. It's not really clear what the death of the Kohen Gadol has to do with the Rotzeach Bishkaga. Rashi offers two deos. Maybe you should have davened a little bit more. On the one hand, so maybe there's an element of culpability. The Gemara in Makos says that his mother sent pastries over, which is, a very fascinating thing. So if you just give me 1 second, I'll finish the point here. So I think that this is definitely part of the observation that we made at the beginning of the death of Aaron really standing out, but I'd actually like to focus on a different element of that. It is really striking that the penalty for Rotzeach Bishkaga, it'd be one thing if you said, look, if you're a Rotzeach Bishkaga, you go to an Ir Miklat for a year, or you go to an Ir Miklat for 5 years, or you go to the Ir Miklat for 10 years. I don't know, make some uniform sentence. So how is that just? You could be a Rotzeach Bishkaga and never get out because Kohen Gadol happens to live for a very long time. You could be a Rotzeach Bishkaga and, spend a month there, and then,
it's a kapara, which is not fulfilled until the Kohen Gadol dies.
But how does that just? You have two people who kill accidentally. One is there for a month, and one is there for his lifetime. How do you justify that? How is that fair?
The idea of waiting for a particular instance which you can't predict, which is happenstance, when the Kohen Gadol will die, is equivalent to the guy who murders by accident. It was circumstances, it was happenstance. The guy who has premeditated, that's a plan. So equivalent would be, like you said, for premeditated, you do lifetime, you do 10 years, you do 30 years, it's the equivalent to it, because it's well thought out. If it's by chance this way, then his salvation is by chance also.
I assume Toronto is your location and not your name.
Today it's any name. It's both actually, but that's okay.
I happen to fully agree with the way that you said that, very precisely. I'm totally in agreement with you. I think that is the basic idea. Just to raise your consciousness, the Sforno has a very fascinating theory of this case. The Sforno says that actually, because there are so many gradations of shogeg, he said this is halokim inali yado, that this is the divine element there, that a Kadosh Baruch Hu will see to it that those people who have more guilt end up there, later, and those people who are, let's say, not quite karav lonis, because if you're karav lonis, you don't really have to go to begin with. But if you're sort of shogeg karov la'ones, he says you'll end up there for much shorter. So the Sforno was bothered, and the Sforno is a suggestion. I happen to, Toronto, I like your suggestion very much. I think that's, that's really the pshat. But again, there's a kind of, if you think about it, there's kind of a compromise here, right? Because what's really going on is that we're saying this person, can't be exonerated without, any consequence. On the other hand, the person is not guilty of capital murder in the volitional sense of the term. And so we have to find some way of satisfying the competing needs. On the one hand, he doesn't deserve to die. And on the other hand, he doesn't deserve to resume his life as such, because whether a person is killed by Rotzeach Mezid or a person is killed by Rotzeach Bishkaga, they're equally dead. So, from the standpoint of the victim, there has to be some expiation. It's a very fascinating thing. The Torah says there's an Issa Daraisa. In the Torah, V'lo Sikhu Kofer Lanefesh Rotzeach Asher Hu Rosh Alamos. And the next pasuk is V'lo Sikhu Kofer Lanus El Ir Miklato. That just like there's an Issa Daraisa to allow somebody to pay their way out of capital murder, there's an Issa Daraisa to have somebody pay their way out of the Ir Miklat. There's there's a certain parallel there. But in any event, it strikes me as a kind of a compromise. All right. And then let's go to the last incident of Sefer Bamidbar, which, you know, hopefully we'll now begin to tie everything together, and we'll see where we're going with all of this. So what's the last incident of Sefer Bamidbar? He just as a hint,
the,
right?
The Benos Tulafchad marrying their uncles. The Benos Tulafchad.
So we know back in Parshas Pinchas, the Benos Tulafchad said, "Lama yigarashem avinu mitoch mishpachto kein lo bein tanalanu achuza besoch achay avinu bayakrev Moshe's mishpatan l'dnei Hashem." Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't respond right away. Apparently, there's some controversy there, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu says, "Kein Benos Tulafchad davros nason titena machuzas nachala." Besoch achay avihen, ve'ha'avarta es nachalas avihen lahen, the lashon ha'avara. And what is the counterclaim of the Matei b'nei Yosef, of the leaders of the tribe of Menashe? What is their concern?
Their concern is if the women marry men from a different shevet, then the land will go over to that shevet. I mean, they'll still own the land, but they'll be living with, you know, with their husbands in a different part. I don't know how it would work, but the Menashe is concerned about losing out on that portion of land.
Beautiful.
If the women excellent. Marry outside.
Is that Rachel or Rachel? Rachel.
Rachel. Yeah.
Beautiful. Okay. So how is it dealt with?
They end up marrying their uncles, I believe.
So right. So how does HaKadosh Baruch Hu respond?
He says they need to marry within their shevet.
So just like in Parshas Pinchas, we had the words Kain, Benos, Tzlavcha, Dovros. You have that exact construct verbatim. Kain, Matei, B'nei Yosef, Dovrim. You're right, and you are right.
Rabbi.
Just one second. The Tov, B'neihem, Tiana, L'Nashim. They should marry whoever they want. Ach, L'Matei. Mishpachas avihen tiana l'nashim. Okay, so Chazal tell us it was limited to that generation. The Ramban weighs that back and forth. But the point is that there is some kind of a compromise, right? And then I would get back to Toronto in just a second. But that you have to work things out in a way that's equitable. And in this case, it means they should not be compelled to marry somebody they do not wish to marry. In Aisha Miskadesha Salamidaita, right? That's a, you know, like an arch principle in marriage. Gerushin could be Bal Karcha Midaraisa, but not Kiddushin. It's very, very important. She has a say. But, you know, in this case, there has to be a balance of her needs, of Machla Noach Aga Milka Tirza, their personal needs, with the needs of Shevet Menashe. And so, Kain Benos Lovcha Dovros, it's not a stira, Kain Matei Bnei Yosef Dovrim. So, let me just pause right here. I want to go back to Toronto. And then I'd like to try to, you know, draw the through line between, you know, all four sections of narrative in Matos Masi that we're talking about, and then, you know, sort of begin to really put things together. Yes, Toronto.
All right. So earlier you seemed to give approbation or criticism of the tribe that built shelters for their animals before shelters for their wives and children. Their priorities were skewed. So I would say the same thing is going on here. The happiness of the women is subsumed by the concern of the tribe to keep land. And the happiness of the women, I think, because it doesn't leave Eretz Yisrael. It's just which tribe is relatively bigger or not. Who cares? So their happiness is a concern below the tribe keeping a certain amount of land. And to me, they're equivalent problems. There's a criticism there. Why should they care so much about land?
You know, respectfully, I disagree. I think that if land were in Eretz Yisrael were not significant, their claim on its face would have been irrelevant.
But what's the difference if your tribe has 10.2 square miles or 10.4 square miles? The total land of Eretz Yisrael doesn't change. So okay, you have bragging rights. I'm taller than you are.
I heard you. I heard the point, but I'm saying in response is, so what's the difference if Eretz Yisrael, which is the same, goes to their uncles or it goes to them? Who cares? It's Eretz Yisrael. That's what you're saying. Who cares who gets
there? But their happiness in terms of choosing a spouse is limited by this.
They could have married whoever they wanted. Why do they have to make a big fuss about the land?
They have to have property. Like, you know, property was an important thing.
Okay, so, but if they get
married off.
But I'm just pointing out there's an inconsistency in your argument. You're saying, oh, why should it matter who has the land, right? So I'm saying what's good for the goose is good for the gander. So then why?
Our nesa is not the same thing. This way they have more of a trousseau or whatever you want, and it keeps their father's name alive because this will be known as tzlafchad's.
So why is that only true at the level of them perpetuating their father's name and not true also at the level of the integrity of the Nachlav Shevet Menashe? The clear response of the Torah is that Matei B'nei Yosef have the same legitimacy to their claim as B'nos Slavchad. You can't get more parallel. Kein B'nos Slavchad Dovros, Kein Matei B'nei Yosef Dovrim. It's not really a debatable point.
I would debate it longer, but I'll let you continue.
Okay. I just don't think the Torah is very ambiguous about it. Yeah, please. Was that Noreen? Go ahead.
I thought that the amount of land that was awarded to each tribe had to do with the amount of people that they had. So therefore, you know, if the tribe, you know, if they needed that amount of land to sustain that amount of people. But I think in the Torah, everything is always decided on the basis of what's good for the community, not so much for the individual. The individual is important, but the community, I think, supersedes that.
Well, I would say there's a balance here. I don't think it's necessarily one or the other. So remember, latov beinehen tiana lenashim. They shouldn't be forced to marry somebody they don't want to marry. But at the same time, achlam atei mishpachas avien tiana lenashim. As far as your first point there, Noreen, that is actually a machlokes, whether each tribe got the same amount of territory. The Ramban is actually very, very strongly of that view, other Rishonim or not. But the question is, was the land divided on the basis of equal shares, or was the land divided on the basis of value, right? Because if you have equal shares, like actually the same amount of land, so then, if the land is actually worth more, right, it's just better real estate, so then it's not really equal. So there's a huge debate on that point. It's not entirely clear. But what the Ramban ends up saying is that since this stipulation was only made for that generation, the generation of distribution of the land, says, look, eventually you're going to have people who have, land in areas that were part of a different tribal distribution. However, when the land was distributed, at least it should be distributed in principle, by the way that the Torah originally wanted it to be distributed based on the Goral. So he thinks that, as he says, there's a much greater kapeda in the initial generation. Yeah, Annie, go ahead.
I would say that the tribe of Menashe would be especially worried about losing land since Hashem had already divided them in half in the first parsha and decided that half of the tribe of Menashe would live on the other side of the Jordan with Gad and Reuven. So already they lost half the amount of their allotment, did they not? Or just half the population went?
We call it Chatzi Shevet Menashe, but it's really only two families from Menashe. It's only about 20% of the population, and it wasn't detracted. They didn't lose out. It was purely annexed on. So, but it's a good question.
But it was their choice. It wasn't God telling them to live there. They chose with Reuven and Gad to stay on the other side.
That's not clear.
Didn't they come to Moshe and say, we love this land, it's fertile, we want to stay here?
That's only Gad and Reuven. How Menashe ended up getting there is not clear. The Ramban is of the view that Moshe chose Menashe.
Why would he do that?
That's very interesting. There's a Medrash which actually says that they were put there to watch over Reuben and God, that Menashe was a tribe because they came from Yosef, and we know that Yosef was you know, Mechabe Vesaretz, the Medrash says is that Menashe were there sort of as guardians, that they would keep Reuven and Gad on the straight and narrow, which is a very fascinating discussion. Okay, so let's
lots to talk about. Menashe was also Tamidei Chachamim. Yeah. This is another reason that Moshe really favored them to make sure that they will stay online.
Where do you see that Menashe are like greater Tamidei Chacham?
I've seen it somewhere.
I read it also. In the Stone Chumash. I also read from the Stone Chumash that point, and also the point that if they had relatives, if half of Menashe had relatives in the land of Israel, it would make sure that the areas outside of Israel would be in constant communication.
Right. So that the second approach is definitely, you know, that definitely has traction within a Chazal. But again, in theory, that could have been true of any tribe, right? If you think about it, Moshe could have taken half of Naphtali or a family from Naphtali, right? And that would have been equally true. So I think that there's probably more to be done. I'm totally unfamiliar with any tradition which says that Menashe, like, we're special Talmidei Chachamim. I think if you wanted to go for that, you'd probably be better off with Yisachar, maybe, you know, Yehuda, and, you know, possibly, you know, Levi. You know, those are typically more affiliated with the virtues of Torah learning, but okay. Just to sort of circle back you know, begin to try to put things together. So we saw four stories, right? We saw the story of the aftermath of the War of Midian, and then we talked about B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven, and you know, the reconciliation of that confrontation. Then we talked about the Ir Miklat, and then we talked about the B'nos Lavchad Kein Matei B'nai Yosef Tovrim. Anybody sort of sense like a through line? What would be like a point of commonality between all four of these stories?
Compromise?
Yeah, there you go, right? V'chatzisa samal kalach. It's a compromise, but it's a very principled compromise. It's a very subtle compromise. It's not just, okay, take it, divide it in half, but 12,000 people risk their lives, right? So they get to keep half of it themselves. They have a lower tax rate of 0.2% as opposed to 2%. So that would be, right, number one. The same thing is true of B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven. They're not just going to say, Kivan achalaseinu eleinu me'avei Yarden Mizracha, right? They're going to have to, you know, spend 14 years fighting for Klal Yisrael and making sure that Klal Yisrael has their lands distributed. So there's a compromise that's worked out. The entire institution of Ritzach Bishgaga can be conceptualized as a compromise, right? And the idea is that, you know, lo sikhu kofer le nefesh Ritzach, asher rashalamus, lo sikhu kofer banu salir miklato. They can't get away with it. They can't pay their way out of it with blood money. On the other hand, they're not the equivalent of a Ritzach b'mezid. So you find some space in the middle. And then the ultimate compromise in the Torah, Kain, benos lavchad dovros, Kain, matei b'nei Yosef, Dovrim. So it seems like the end of Sefer Bamidbar is really about the principle of compromise. If you want to know how to find your way out of the Midbar, if you want to know how to move forward into Eretz Yisrael, into life with all of its complications, there's an overarching principle that we like to call pshara, of compromise, that nobody can get everything that they want. Otherwise, what one has is a zero-sum, you know, vortex, which leads to confrontation. Now, if you had to choose one person, you know, in all of, you know, Jewish history, in all of, you know, our Masora, who's affiliated with the principle of Pshara, who would it be?
Aaron.
Without a doubt, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Vav Amud Beis, contrasts Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen. And it contrasts them in terms of, you know, halachic context. Moshe Rabbeinu is associated with the expression of Yikov Hadin Esahar. Law, and whatever the law is, was going to carry the day. Aaron, Ohev Shalom V'Rodev Shalom, the Gemara says, would always try to get the Baalei Din, the litigants, to pursue Pshara. The Rambam, interestingly, in that sugya, Rambam Beis Design of Aleph, says that we pask in a mitzvah livtzoa, that Kol Bezdin, this is a citation of the Rambam, Kol Bezdin osa pshara tamid hareza mishubach, that we always privilege pshara over pure din. It's a remarkable idea. And that idea is really the life's work of Hevi Mitalmidev Shel Aharon, Ohev Shalom Verodev Shalom. We're trying very, very hard to balance the needs of Emes as well as Shalom. The Torah tells us, or I should rather say the Navi tells us, the Pasuk in Malachi describing Aharon HaKohen, Torah's Emes Haisa B'fihu, he was a person of great truth, Ve'avo Lo Nimtza B'svasav, B'shalom B'mishar Halachiti, V'rabim Heshiv Me'avon, that Aharon was able to have a profound impact on Klal Yisrael by his capacity to balance Torah's Emes Haisa B'fihu, but B'shalom B'mishar Halachiti, right? The sense of shalom as well. And it doesn't seem like an accident to me. Like the one event that, as we recount all the masaos in retrospect, we talk about Klal Yisrael's journey through the Midbar and ultimately out of the Midbar, seems like the Torah is trying very hard to draw our attention to Aharon HaKohen. We see that a little bit as we discussed in the context of the Ir Miklat and the Ritzach Bishgaga as well. It's Admos HaKohen HaGadol, taking us back to the persona of Aharon HaKohen as well. Somehow that's involved in this story, that it's really about the idea of a compromise, of trying to find a just solution to a tragic and thorny situation. I think when we understand this yisod, this foundational point, in reflecting on the end of Sefer Bamidbar and the beginning of Klal Yisrael's, you know, entry into Eretz Yisrael, we recognize how critically valuable compromise is. Compromise in certain circles today has become like a dirty word. You know, people think that somebody who compromises is like, you know, unprincipled. Nothing could be further than the truth. Compromise is a principle. It's a high principle. It's a noble principle. And it's a recognition at one level that, you know, people, you know, have legitimately different perspectives, that the MS is very hard to perceive. It's not always entirely clear, you know, what the right thing is. Rabbi Kelman, in a different context at the beginning of this year, referenced Elu Va'elu Devrei Elokim Chayim. It's not always clear, you know, what is right and what is wrong. And Pshara, in that way, responds to how elusive MS can be. But I think equally important is, even if you know what MS is, sometimes, you know, one can achieve MS and, you know, make lasting enemies and, you know, create very, very significant problems, you know, on the back end. You can, you know, push for unconditional surrender, you know, and destroy and annihilate your adversary of the Treaty of Versailles. And you can wake up 20 years later and yet you have, you know, the whirlwind. And that's true in history, and that's true in life, and that's true in relationships. And Pshara is an arch principle, right? You have, everybody's been watching the events in Eretz Yisrael for many, 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 many months. And there are people, you know, who will tell you that judicial reform is, you know, the single most important thing since Maimon Har Sinai. And there are people that will tell you that opposing judicial reform is the single most important thing since Maimon Har Sinai. But all we can really say for certain is that it'll tear Klal Yisrael apart unless you can find, you know, some meaningful compromise. And that's true there, and it's true in different ways here. And, you know, the vilification of those who compromise is, you know, an extremely dangerous kind of a phenomenon. There's a reason that the halacha determines, kol bezdin osep shara tamid hareza mishubach, that it's always praiseworthy to look wherever possible for some degree of compromise, because otherwise you have just, you know, untenable, you know, kinds of situations where even if one party legitimately, you know, wants to claim total victory, that's going to leave, you know, an embittered, defeated foe, and you're going to have, you know, very, very, very serious problems over the long term. And that's, you know, really a message that, you know, there's a, one of the most important contributions in general of an important, very, very important professor that actually started publishing a lot of his work this year. His 25th Yortzeit was just marked, is Professor Isidore Twersky, who's a professor in Harvard and the son-in-law of the Rav. And one of the points that he wrote about, you know, most was the intellectual history of extremism and moderation. There's no question that right now we're in a period of extremism all over the world, right? Extremism is very, very popular. It's associated with being, you know, more authentic, and, you know, people stake out their positions and they're unable to lend any credence, any veracity, even any humanity sometimes to the other point of view. And we see the results of this. The results of this are, generally speaking, extremely deleterious and really threaten to, you know, undo the fabric of society. So if you ask me, you know, what's the end of Sefer Bamidbar? What's the parting message? Parting message is to find v'chatzisa samal koach. The parting message is to establish a Tanai b'nei Gad u'b'nei Reuven. The parting message is to find a way of dealing with the Ratzeach b'shkaga that doesn't, you know, whitewash the fact that there's a Nirtzach, that there's a person who's dead, but at the same time doesn't equate him to Ratzeach Mezid. And it's to say, Kein b'no slavcha dovros, Kein mate b'nei Yosef dovrim. The person who we can't forget, of all of the Maasei b'nei Yisrael, the person whose legacy is literally unforgettable, is Aaron HaKohen. His life message of Ava Shalom and Medifa Shalom is really the key for the success, for the viability of any society. The moment that we enter into, like, you know, a winner-take-all, you know, kind of situation is essentially the moment that we doom ourselves, because a society can never stand for any length of time in that kind of contract. But what ultimately will happen, you know, in that kind of arrangement is that there will be, you know, a massive backlash. And when you deal with that, you deal with, you know, very, very, very dangerous things. And again, it's important for us to be mindful of, as, you know, both here in this country and Eretz Yisrael. I can't speak to Canada as much, but, you know, there's a lot of polarization, which is the result of a stigmatization of compromise that is totally anathema to the halachic tradition. Halachic tradition really, really prizes meaningful compromise. And, you know, that's, I think, the legacy, you know, of Aaron HaKohen, and becomes, you know, the parting message of Sefer Bamidbar, Kein b'nos slavcha dovros, Kein matei b'nei Yosef dovrim, you're right and you're right, you both have legitimate points, now we'll go and figure it out, you know, in practice, how we're going to, you know, try to work out, you know, a viable solution, a modus vivendi. In this world, you know, in Olam Hazeh, we're always going to need to be able to find meaningful compromise to be able to ensure the health and viability of society. But thank everybody very much for their very, very thoughtful participation. And, you know, wish everybody a wonderful shop.
Interestingly,
a few minutes to take questions here. So by all means, go ahead.
Pinchas doesn't compromise at all, and yet God gives him a brit shalom. Isn't that a contradiction in the word shalom? Shalom itself can be ambivalent. We learn that from Pinchas.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. You know, so there's a Gemara in Zvachim and Daf Kuf, which talks about when did Pinchas, you know, fully ascend to being a Kohen? And there are two deos in that Gemara. One dea is, as you're suggesting, of Lo Niskayin Pinchas Ad Sheharago LeZimri, that it was, you know, through that act of violence. The other
which the Ishvitzer says he shouldn't have done.
What's that?
Which the Ishvitzer says he shouldn't have done.
Okay, yeah, just let's give me a second. Let's just stick to the Gemara for a second. That's, you know. So the Gemara says, you know, there's another Deya, which is Lo Niskayin Pinchas Ad She'asa Shalom Bein Hashvatim. So Pinchas, as you undoubtedly recall, in the 22nd chapter of Sefer Yehoshua, leads a peace delegation. There was the threat of a civil war, you know, between Reuven and Gad and the rest of Klal Yisrael over some of the issues that we discussed today of separatism. And Pinchas leads a peace delegation and is able to, you know, really, you know, mediate this. And according to that day in the Gemara, that's really when, you know, Pinchas achieved the bris kuna salam. But in any event, even if one assumes the first day, which is Lo Niskayin Pinchas Ad Sheharago LeZimri, I wouldn't be too bothered by that question. It's sort of like a reductio ad absurdum. certainly, as indicated, Pshara is an overriding value, an arch value. Does that mean in every single case? You know, no. Probably the outer boundary case is, you know, as the Gemara says, Vayar Pinchas Mara'a, Rosh and Chachme Vein Tuna Vein Eitzel and Neged Hashem, V'Makom Chol Hashem in Cholkin Kavod HaRav. In extreme situations, this is Gemara in Sanhedrin Pei Beis, in extreme situations of Chol Hashem, so there's a permission structure for Kanaim Poginbo. That's the exception that proves the rule. That doesn't in any way compromise the idea that, you know, Pshara remains, you know, Shlomo HaMelech also wrote Eish Shalom Ve'Eish Melchama. Does Eish Melchama mean that Pshara isn't the overriding? Of course not, right? So it's not like, you know, they're equal. There are extreme situations where we don't have a choice. But, you know, as a basic value, you know, the Rambam was justified in writing at the end of Hilchos Megillah V'Chanukah, Lo Nisna Torah El Laso Shalom Ba'olam. You know, that's clearly the dominant motif.
Perhaps another example of the exception involved Aharon himself when trying to stave off the people waiting for Moshe to return, and then it resulted in the golden calf. When Moshe came down, he said, what did they do to make you do such a thing? In other words, he was displeased at Aharon's efforts, which may have been to try and reach a compromise or put them off. But in that case also, perhaps there should have been a different approach rather than.
I happen to completely agree with you, Alan. I think that, you know, that is, you know, obviously the one, you know, stain on Aaron's otherwise, you know, very pristine legacy. And I think that's exactly right. That's exactly correct. That Aaron HaKohen was a figure who was always looking for a pshara. And the Cheda Egel is an outer boundary point. That's where there are some things, just, you know, absolute extreme situations with which we can't compromise. But again, those are the exceptions, you know, the Harig Val Yavors and not the rule. So I think you're right. I think there, you know, Moshe's orientation of Yikov Adin HaSahar, you know, not trying to play along in Chag L'Hashem Machar and all these things, that would have been better. Now again, you know, if you want to, you know, we can spin this out in so many different ways, but, you know, Vayiven Mizbeach Lefanav, the Gemara tells us, you know, Ra'a Chur Zavuach Lefanav, you know, Chur had tried to, you know, take that road and ended up dead. So it's a very, very, very tricky thing. But I happen to agree with you that, you know, everything has its limits, and even compromise, you know, has its limits, as Gershon was pointing out before, you know, in terms of Pinchas, in terms of what you're pointing out, the Egel Zav. It's not to say that we should, you know, find a way to live with Avodah Zarah. That obviously wasn't my point. But, you know, that within, you know, essential parameters, that Pshara is, you know, an overriding value, that I think is really the point here.
How do you explain that the Shevatim, the two Shevatim, Reuven and Gad, gave 14 years until the end of the Nachalot, and then as soon as they go back, there's almost a civil war. So, and when, how come Shevet Menashe did not send some percentage of soldiers together with Gad and Reuven?
They did.
No. It's not clear.
In the 22nd chapter of Sefer Yehoshua, I don't see any distinction between Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Menashe.
No, that they did not send also representation to help to the other Shevatim. Shevet Menashe, like it was, not involved with sending soldiers.
You want to just try that again? I think I lost you. I'm not sure what you're...
Okay. Two questions. Shevet Reuven and Gad sent soldiers to help until the conquest of Israel for 14 years. Shevet Menashe did not.
You lost me. Where do you get that from? Why do you say that?
It's not written in the Tanakh that they sent. Only
okay, so I, Reuven, I, again, I, you know, if you look in Sefer Yoshua in Perek Aleph, it seems to me indisputable. Yoshua says to Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Menashe, you promised Moshe, you have to go first.
They never promised. Menashe, they never promised.
Can I just read the pasuk to you?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. I mean, I don't think this is really a debatable point. So this is, I'll just open it up because I don't have the Tanakh in front of me, but I'll open it up in a second. This is like the greatness of the internet. So it says here, this is, I'm reading from Sefer Yoshua Perek Aleph. This is, Pasuk Yidbeis. La Ruveni v'la Gadi v'la Chatzis Shevet Amnasha Mar Yehoshua Lemor. Zachoras Adavar Shotziva Tzchem Moshe Ebed Hashem Lemor. Hashem Elkechem Niach Lachem. Ad Asher Niach Hashem Elkechem Gachem Yershu Gam Hema. He's talking to Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Menashe. It's explicit in the Tanakh.
Okay, so after serving for 14 years, right, to the end of the conquest, they're going back just to the other side of the Jordan, and they make a Galed, and suddenly, almost erupted, a civil war. Can you explain that?
I think so.
They gave so much to the brothers, to the 7.5, whatever, to the 9.5 Shvatim. They helped them so much. And as soon as they moved to the other side, almost a civil war erupted. There was no relation between them.
Well, but I'm not sure whether it's intentional or not, but you're skipping over a very important detail. What did they do?
They built
a Mizbeach that was interpreted by Klal Yisrael to be a separate religious center.
But it wasn't. They didn't.
It wasn't like Klal Yisrael, you know, declared war on them. They thought that they wanted to secede. They built a Mizbeach, and then... You know, Reuven and Gad clarify that this is just our way of, you know, memorializing that we're really connected to Eretz Yisrael. There was a misunderstanding. That's what I was alluding to, that Pinchas clarified it. But it wasn't, as you say, so clear on its face.
No.
It's very strange. All the situation is very strange because if they lived together with them for those 14 years, I would expect some different relations, the outcome. In the civil war.
They built a mizbeach. People didn't know what to do with it.
But the people that were left behind, maybe they are the ones who built it, or they are the ones who needed some connection to the east side, the west side of the country.
Yeah, I'm not sure I followed that. I think the point is that it was a misunderstanding, you know, and that it was interpreted by the, you know, main group of Klal Yisrael as something, you know, highly provocative and separatist, and it wasn't meant in that way. And Pinchas is able, thank God, to clear things up before any shots are fired. It's a, you know, like a catastrophe averted.
Rabbi, if I may,
I
agree with you. Compromise in Israel's being torn apart now, and et cetera, et cetera. Do you want to compromise on how I think that the halachic authorities today are also much less. There's been an extremism in the halachic approach to everything. I mean, if you want to take a real extreme example, I guess to really push the question, let's take women's issues. So let's say you think women rabbis are terrible, but like, or women aliyot. I mean, you know, it's not like, you know, you can quote a Gemara. The Gemara says women had aliyot. So you say we haven't done that, et cetera. In other words, but it's not just on these controversial issues. I think the halachic system today has lost the sense of compromise. The rabbanim today are not as open to other ideas. It's sort of my way or the highway, or you don't follow, you're out of our community. I don't know if you want to comment on that. I think there's a lot there, unfortunately, or whatever. I just like to hear your response.
I think it's very hard to generalize. I'm not entirely sure I would, you know, like, writ large subscribe to that. But you know, one, you know, it, to the extent that there might be some small C conservative impulse, I would say two things. You know, first of all, I think some of the greatest poskim, if you're really looking towards the top, is really where you see the most flexibility. Two very salient examples come to mind. There's Chacham Ovadia's approach to the Agunos after the Yom Kippur War, which was, you know, remarkable in terms of, you know, his capacity to be Matir 900 plus, you know, the special Bate Din of 1974, went so far beyond, you know, the extant halachic literature, and really was, I think, pretty much the only time in of note in Chacham Ovadia's, you know, long and distinguished career where he was willing to go against the Shulchan Aruch in terms of, you know, evidentiary standards necessary to release a woman and to rely on those deos yachid in those situations. So, you know, I think, and the other example that came to mind was definitely Rav Moshe in terms of issues of mamzerus and you know, referring here to, you know, non-orthodox, let's call it.
Yeah. The problem is, I think you're strengthening my point. Rav Moshe died in 1986, and Rav Avadia died in 2009 or so, and Rav Avadia was a Sephardic. Look at what they did to Rav Gorn on the Langer case. You know, look at the reaction there, and there, you know, and especially today, it's the exact opposite. In other words, the people who said that Rav Gorn was being Matar Mamzerim because you can never undo a conversion are the sort of the same people today who say that conversions done 50 years ago are no good because the Orthodox rabbis had lower standards.
So I would just point again, I didn't know what time when they were talking about, you know, I would say two, like, I don't think anybody would question two of the greatest postkim of the previous generation, you know, had major kulas, you know.
I agree with you. I agree. My question is now, I totally agree. Rav Moshe is amazing. That's correct. Rav Moshe, the great poskim. My point is, I don't see it anymore today. The Rav Tzvi Pesach Franks and the Sri Dei Eish and these poskim who really were attuned to what society was like. Even Rav, I mean, all throughout history today, I think, you know, I don't want to say it's in a sense, but there's a much more political approach, you know, the sort of party lines. And I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but I just, what I see in the halakhic leaders of today, you don't see this leadership and this willingness to take.
Again, I don't, you know, like, I guess you could, you know.
Maybe
you,
I'm wrong. Right. That's why I'm asking you to comment.
I don't know. Yeah. So I would say, look, you know, this is a little bit, you know, outside of the whatever you want to call it, the centrist Orthodox world, but just to give you like some examples of, you know, in the Haredi world, people tend to think, you know, all the Haredim are the same. But let's say Reb Aaron Leib Steinman and Reb Edelstein, who just recently passed away, both of them took positions supportive of Haredi men serving in Nachal Haredi if they did not want to learn. And that they were vilified within their own communities for that. When I say vilified, even subjected to violence in some cases. So that took tremendous, you know, moral courage. Now, again, from where people on this Zoom may be sitting, it would be like, you know, obvious, everybody should serve in Tzal, but it's certainly not obvious to them. So I think there's a lot of it is relative to, you know, where what a person's starting assumptions are. So I would, you know, be, I don't know if I could, I would, I certainly wouldn't want to paint
push
that.
Back. It's okay to push back. I was,
you
just,
know, I would just say that, you know, I wouldn't paint with that broader brush. I think it's just, there's different people out there. You know, and the other thing that I think is, you know, part of what's going on is that, to the extent that I could agree, I think that some of it has to do with the idea that, you know, in a society where basically everybody is on the same page in terms of Shabbos, Kashrus, Taras HaMishpacha, so there's probably some greater flexibility, you know,
Jacob Katzer,
on other issues. But like when there is this sense that, you know, we're fighting for survival and there's, you know, historic levels of assimilation, maybe now is not the time to be lowering standards. So that's where I think, you know, people will differ. People will say, no, this is Dafka when we should be, you know, more compromising. Other people will say this is Dafka when we need to really, you know, assert standards. And I think that that's like, it's hard to, I think both of those can be very sincere approaches. So I would, you know, okay. I would say that's part of the story also.
All right. I think there's more to discuss here, but thank you. And if anybody else has any comments, otherwise we'll wish everybody Laila Tov. Of course, tomorrow morning, my share on the Siddur at 9:30. We'll talk about love of God. We're at the Shema. V'avdat Hashem, finish Baruch Hashem, Kum Akuto, and V'avdat Hashem. And then Rabbi Liebtag on Sunday, continuing our classes. I'm going to just put it right here. If you haven't registered yet for the Tisha B'Av program in 2 weeks, I know I don't look forward to Tisha B'Av, but it's really, I think, if I can say so myself, an excellent program. If you haven't had a chance, that would be from 11 till 7, 8 hours straight of learning for those. What else is there to do on Tisha B'Av? Baruch Hashem, many people learn more Torah on Tisha B'Av on the one day you're not supposed to learn Torah. We were discussing the other day, and we've sort of changed. That's an area where there's been a lot of change, you know, the way we say keynote and the way movies and learning, and it's not all exactly as the Shulchan Aruch describes it, and I think we all agree that's a positive thing, that this is an area where we have to compromise, and we can be a little bit makil on learning things that may be strictly speaking outside the parameters, okay? Would you agree with that, Rabbi? I think you would agree with that. Well, you know, anyways, you don't have to comment. I don't mean to put you on the hot seat, but you know, Tisha B'Av has really undergone a change in the last 25 years. I think maybe you're too young to know what Tisha B'Av used to be like. So you're in the new Tisha B'Av since the Chafetz Chaim movies and everything, but Tisha B'Av, oh boy. Anyways, all right, we should hear good things. We should have Tisha B'Av as a holiday. If we learn to compromise and to get along, maybe that can happen. Avat Chinam, that's what we need. Okay, everybody. Thank you, Rabbi. And we should have happy occasions, and always a pleasure. And thank you for engaging everybody. They were engaged, but you helped engage them. And we hope to see you all soon. And everybody, please invite a friend. And Shabbat Shalom, everybody. We'll see you soon, please God, for good occasions. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you for a very enriching evening. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night, Laila Tov.